Now, all this talk of these cosmological tensions and conflicting results from different experiments brings to the fore how science itself is constantly evolving, just like dark energy might be, it seems. Our next guest, Timothy Behrens, a neuroscientist at Oxford University in the UK, believes that science journals should do a better job of reflecting that fact. For more than a century, science publishing has followed more or less the same model. Scientists write up their research in a paper and then send their manuscript to a science journal for consideration. Some journals are more prestigious than others, carrying what's known as a higher impact factor, which basically means that their articles tend to be more highly cited by other scientists. This is where the gatekeeping kicks in. The editors of the journal make an initial decision about whether the paper is worthy of consideration. If they think that it is, they send it out to reviewers, professional scientists who are subject area experts on the paper's topic. The reviewers then mull over the paper and send back their thoughts. Perhaps they recommend that the paper should be accepted, or they ask for some revisions to be made, or maybe they'll reject the paper outright. In this way, the reviewers hold a huge amount of power. On the podcast page, qspace.fqxi.org/podcasts, I'm linking to a three-part investigation that I carried out about the problems with the peer review system, along with reporters Brendan Foster, Miriam Frankel, and Colin Stewart. One journal that was highly praised by scientists in our investigation was eLife, which was founded in 2012 and handles biomedical and life sciences papers. In 2023, it went through a radical overhaul, upending the way that it publishes papers, to lessen the power of the reviewers. Now, eLife's editors alone decide whether a paper is good enough to be published. Those papers that are accepted are still sent out for review, but even if the reviewer hates the paper, it won't be rejected. Instead, with the author's consent, the paper and the review reports are all posted to the eLife site. This is an example of post-publication peer review. The authors may then choose to revise the content of the paper, and eLife will review it again, until the authors decide that they've reached the final version of their paper and end the reviewing process. This publishing experiment has hit some problems. Last year, it was announced that due to its unconventional approach, eLife would no longer be assigned an impact factor. Reporter Miriam Frankel caught up with eLife's editor-in-chief, Timothy Behrens, to ask him about the successes and challenges of this radical new approach to peer review.
The not-for-profit open access journal eLife is trying to shake up the scientific publishing system. I sat down with its editor, Timothy Behrens, from the University of Oxford, to talk about the journal's mission.
eLife is a biology journal, a collaboration between a bunch of top biologists and a bunch of top biology funders who are trying to make an impact on the publication world with various incentives: openness, transparency, and decisions being scientist-led being amongst them, but also trying to understand how we open up the publication world to a broader set of ideas and what roadblocks there'll be on the way.
How are you funded?
Two ways. First, by our article processing charges, which fund some portion of our operation, and the other by central backing, which was originally from our three founding charitable partners, the Max Planck Institute, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and the Wellcome Trust. There's also some new funders that come on along the way.
What are the article processing charges right now?
$2,500.
How successful has it been?
So eLife originally started off with an intention of playing the same game that the rest of the publishers play, but doing it in an open, transparent way, using peer review to select papers. And we made a very high quality journal. We were getting 600-700 papers a month. And then we decided we were making an impact, but we were not really making a transformational impact. We were just doing the same thing as other journals. We think we were doing it better. And so we decided to do a much more transformational thing which is to get rid of peer review as a gatekeeping and just to have peer review as a transparent opinion, effectively. And so after we review everything, we will publish everything that we review along with the reviews, even if the reviews don't think that the work is solid or strong. It's a way of making peer review an open conversation rather than gatekeeping. And in terms of submissions, we did not see a big hit when we introduced this model. We were up again to 600 submissions a month pretty quickly. People liked it. And then we hit some roadblocks. We lost our impact factor. And we think that in the long term, that's going to be a good thing as well. Part of our mission is that we should find out where these roadblocks are and we should learn how to overcome them. But in the short term, we've taken a hit in submissions and we're now publishing about two-thirds of the volume that we published before.
Did you lose the impact factor solely because you removed peer review as gatekeeping?
The question why is a deep one here. The impact factor is not something that we have ever supported. We've never advertised it and we've never gamed it, unlike every other journal, I think. We were aware that people in the traditional publishing world were going to try and fight against it. We think it would have been perfectly possible for these people to index us in the same way that they indexed us before under this new model, and we put loads of proposals for them to do so. But they say if we are publishing things which we don't think are solid, then those things are not validated by peer review. We think this is a mistake for lots of reasons. The first thing, it sort of tacitly states that they think that all science is complete. And so when we publish something and say it's incomplete, which all science is, by the way, then they think that that's a damning thing. It's not. It's part of a transparent conversation. The second thing is, we don't prevent authors getting peer reviews from us and then taking them to another journal. In some cases, we've said work isn't finished or work does not support the claims. And then other journals have published it without any changes. And Clariver are very happy to index the work at that other journal, even after we've said it's incomplete. There's so many ironies here.
Are there any international differences in how researchers have responded?
It turns out, actually, that different sets of people need to play the game differently, depending on what their university think and their local grant ecostructure. So people in the UK, for example, our submissions have increased since we lost the impact factor because almost all of our universities have signed DORA. DORA is the Declaration of Research Assessment, where a funder says they won't look at the impact factor, they won't look at the journal name when they're evaluating science, they'll look at the science itself. So Northern Europe, pretty strong as well. In China, no university has signed that document, as far as I'm aware, and some explicitly make you put the impact factor in your tenure applications. And so, of the drop of submissions that we've seen a huge drop of submissions from China. In America, it's different across the states. The really big research-heavy institutions in America are quite like the European ones. Like, we've spoken to MIT, and I think that MIT have said, yeah, whatever, we don't care about web of science, we don't care about impact factors. Whereas I think there are many universities, often state universities, who don't feel like they're as qualified to evaluate their own people based on the science. And so they find it more convenient to use metrics like the impact factor. And so we've seen something like 30 or 40% drop from the US.
Have you had an influx of lower quality papers at all?
We ask our reviewers some questions about how good the paper is, how interesting the paper is, and how solid the paper is, basically. Effectively, we get a bunch of scores. And we were very lucky that we got a controls data set before moving to the new model of those scores of a whole year. And so we know what the baseline was. And as far as we could see, there's been no change in that baseline.
Do you think that the model adds strain on either authors, reviewers, or editors?
Well, the different kinds of strain. I used to be a senior editor under the old model. The one thing I used to hate was, like, these people have been through peer review. And it's taken them months, sometimes years. And then we're sat there with a bunch of peer reviews which say, it's basically okay, but it's a bit boring. Or which say, oh, they haven't quite proven exactly what they're claiming. And then you end up rejecting it and they've got to start again. Whenever I do it, it's like emotionally stressful because I know it's extremely bad news for the authors. And they've just fallen on the wrong side of an arbitrary binary line about whether we'll publish or not. I love having got rid of that. You're now in an open conversation where you've got a much more softer set of criteria. Does it take a little more time because it's all transparent and public and people want to do a good job in public? I think maybe it does take a little more time from the reviewers and the editors. I think that's probably good. I think they're being more responsible because it's all done in the public. Are there stressful events for the authors when people publicly say they disagree with the work? I think like it's super rare, but it probably does happen. Maybe people think that it's scary to have those peer reviews public. But actually, the moment they are public, everybody can see how much of an opinion it is.
That was Timothy Behrens chatting with Miriam Frankel. I'm adding a link to a Q&A with Behrens on the podcast page, qspace.fqxi.org/podcasts, in which he talks about some of the things that haven't been covered in this podcast. For instance, how the journal navigated some well-publicised controversies involving eLife's staff.